This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Often, the Western media portrays Sweden as a sort of modernist utopia, where blonde-haired trendmakers export up-tempo pop music and hip furniture, whilst the government offers up unparalleled maternity leave and a long history of generous immigration policies. I have myself at times joked to my wife, we should just move to Sweden, as though life itself would simply be easier there. But this is not how Sweden is depicted in Michael Booth's new book, The Almost Nearly Perfect People, Behind the Myth of the Scandinavian Utopia. Booth is British-born but has lived in Denmark for many years now, and in his book he wryly describes Swedes as a stiff and conformist people paralyzed by good manners and their government as a sort of benign totalitarianism. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing, Taylor?
I'm very well. So, Michael, as I started out by talking about how the Western world sees Sweden, can you tell me how Sweden is viewed by the rest of Scandinavia?
Well, that's the interesting thing, really. I mean, that's kind of why I started to write this book many years ago, was that when I moved to Denmark, I discovered there was this weird kind of dysfunctional family relationship up here with the Swedes. They're kind of like the older brother, the head boy, the goody-goody. And they've generated quite a deal of resentment amongst their neighbours and envy over the last couple of hundred years, really. So it was that kind of weird relationship that got me started. I mean, the Danes, well, basically the Swedes won, right? They won history. They won everything. They're rich, successful. They won the territory. They beat the Danes.
They've got IKEA.
They got IKEA. They got Tetra Pak. They had these massive global brands. They had this amazingly well-functioning secular industrial society. And they have remained neutral for a couple of hundred years, supposedly, whilst selling arms to the rest of the world. There's a good deal of kind of accusations of hypocrisy from the Finns and Danes in particular. The Norwegians don't like them terribly much either.
Now, you did a lot of traveling through Scandinavia. You live in Denmark, but you visited all the other countries. And Sweden especially has a very interesting stereotype of a person who's, as I mentioned, stiff, very conformist. Did you find that that was the case in your experience?
Well, yeah, and it's not really me that's kind of decided this. If you ask the Swedes themselves, this is their self-image. It's quite interesting. When there are international surveys done for people to describe themselves in adjectives, the Swedes just use words like stiff, remote, humorless, rule-obsessed, you know. They don't have a very great self-image compared to the Danes, who always describe themselves as the happiest people in the world. And the Swedes do, yes, they do tend to live up to some of their stereotypes. They, you know, Greta Garbo famously wanted to be alone. She was a Swede. Mm-hmm. I always used to think that was just kind of some kind of shtick, but it's true. The Swedes do have isolationist tendencies. It is a huge country, a huge landmass. I think the second largest in Europe. And they have traditionally lived kind of spread apart, not very densely populated. So they're used to getting by themselves. They also have what's called a very high context society, which means that they all are kind of homogenous. They think the same, they eat the same food, drive the same cars, wear the same clothes, see the same films. They think in the same kind of way. In the book, I have a rather kind of flippant chapter where I go to Stockholm and spend a day trying to behave as un-Swedishly as possible.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories from that chapter is where you visited the Nobel Museum and sort of tested their manners.
I ate a pack of potato chips and slurped my Coke underneath a sign saying no eating or drinking. And I also tried to cross the road on red, which is just not done generally in Scandinavia, and would sidle up to people on benches and try and start a conversation or get into a lift with Swedes and see them leave rather than share a lift with me. They're just not very social people. And again, this isn't really me going there and saying, pointing the finger. It's the Swedes themselves. I interviewed their greatest ethnologist, Åke Dahn, who's like the expert on Swedish mentality. He literally wrote the book on it. And he told me he did a similar experiment once where he's been living in the same lovely part of Stockholm for decades and would see the same people on the streets every day, and they'd ignore each other studiously. And so he decided to say hello out of the blue. And he was overwhelmed with the positive response. It was such a revolutionary thing for a Swede to do.
Now, do you think the qualities that the Swedes use to describe themselves, you know, polite, the conformist, later you talk about lacking in chivalry, do you think these are necessary trade-offs required to live in such a successful welfare state like they do?
No, not really, because there are other successful welfare states in Europe that do without that kind of, you know, I'm English, right? So I'm used to these rather baroque, extreme forms of manners, which I agree are kind of, you know, weird. But if I go into a store in Britain, and I've done this, and I've counted how many times in a transaction to buy a newspaper, how many times you say the word please and thank you. It's like 12 or 13 times. It's all, excuse me, please, thank you. Well, so we have a good welfare state, and we're chatty, right? The Swedes have a fantastic welfare state. They're not chatty. I don't think it has anything to do with it.
Well, so you don't think that there's any connection maybe between the sort of isolated sensibility that they hold and the way that the dependent on the state rather than each other?
No, I think more it's a case of high trust societies tend to create a kind of social network, a social kind of foundation in which welfare states flourish very well. Because if you trust each other, if you trust your government and authorities to administer your taxes fairly and to redistribute the wealth fairly, then those welfare states tend to function much better. And that you can see across the Nordic countries, they have high levels of social trust, high levels of social cohesion. The Swedes and the Danes belong to more clubs, associations. They do more voluntary work than almost anyone else in the world. And that certainly helps to knit the fabric of society very closely together.
How does this all connect to the very different history? They're descendants of Vikings, and yet they're now, you know, the most polite peoples we can sort of imagine. How does that all connect?
Well, actually, they're not polite at all. In fact, in my book, I talk about the Swedes as being in the public sphere, the most rude people I've ever met, encountered outside of Hong Kong Chinese. They're incredibly brusque and bad-mannered. You know, if they don't know you on the buses, on the trains, out in public, they use their elbows without apologizing. They don't hold door. You know, they're really, really shockingly rude from an English perspective. And I'm not the only Englishman who's noticed this. So, and maybe that's the Viking gene coming out there. I think the whole Viking thing is rather overstated, actually. This was something that happened 1,000 years ago. But, you know, we were learning more and more about the Vikings, about what a complex, actually very civilized people they were.
Right.
But I'm not sure they were more brutal than anyone else.
I'm speaking with Michael Booth. He's author of The Almost Nearly Perfect People, Behind the Myth of the Scandinavian Utopia. I want to get back to a phrase that I mentioned when I introduced you that really caught me reading the book, benign totalitarianism. You weren't the first to use the term, but it really struck me. What is the argument there that Sweden is in some ways a totalitarianism society?
Well, we're familiar with the concept of a totalitarian state as one with a one-party ruler that dictates, you know, how the country is run.
Right.
Now, Sweden's social democrats pretty much did rule the country for the vast majority of the last 50 to 80 years. So, and yes, there was democracy. Yes, there were elections. But as is the often happens when one party has a lot of power, they took over the judiciary, they took over the media, they took over academia. So social democracy became the national creed, if you like. And so the benign part of it is, you know, they weren't queuing for potatoes like the Russians were. Everyone had a nice car. Everyone had an extremely high standard of living. So again, the wealth was distributed extremely effectively, and they had this fantastic cradle to grave welfare state and safety net. So that was the benign aspect of it. I have met Swedes who have complained that they don't feel particularly free when they're in Sweden, and have they indeed left Sweden because certain freedoms are not officially curtailed, but if, for example, you want to be a mother who stays at home to raise her kids, that's not particularly approved of, and the social systems don't particularly support that. So yeah, you're free, but you're free to be Swedish.
To keep the analogy going a little bit, censorship, I suppose, would be a big part of a totalitarian state. And there has been this sort of agreement not to give a far-right party, the Sweden Democrat Party, very much airtime during the last election. Now, what's the story there, and does it make sense? Does it not make sense?
I can see both sides of this one. You know, the Sweden Democrats are a pretty odious bunch. They have their roots in the neo-Nazi movement in Sweden. They're bigoted, anti-immigration, particularly anti-Muslim. Mm-hmm. I've interviewed them. They're not particularly appealing, and they have kind of stupid and ridiculous views. Now, to put it bluntly, now in Sweden, none of the political parties will work with them. They've been shunned in parliament since they came in the election before last, actually. And the media has kind of self-censored them. So they, and some newspapers wouldn't accept their adverts. They were excluded from debate programs on TV on kind of spurious grounds. Now, this has kind of backfired because they scored 13% in the last election and have a bigger presence in parliament than ever. And there is a sense that that view, that whole dialogue about immigration has become a taboo, and it's rather exploded in the Swedes' faces. This is certainly the view from Denmark, where their own right-wing party has been much more a part of the mainstream for the last 15 years. Indeed, for a lot of the last 15 years, it was the kind of the kingmaker in the government.
And this is the whole, I mean, this is the difference in terms of how we all view freedom of speech. You know, I mean, we know right now we've talked a lot about Charlie Hebdo. The Danish cartoons came up after that. And it seems like there is a very different idea of what freedom of speech should be in Sweden versus in Denmark and versus, I suppose, in the UK and the United States.
Absolutely. And that was really epitomized just a couple of months ago, actually, by a Swedish artist called Park, who, based in Malmö, I believe, created some pretty offensive works of art with showing black people being lynched and really unpleasant art, actually, if you could call it art. His works were confiscated in Sweden, and he came, I think, to live in Copenhagen or spend a lot of time in Copenhagen. And here, people tried to put on a show of his work. And even a state-sponsored radio station promoted him and kind of championed his cause. So the Danes have a very different view. They have a kind of anything-goes view in terms of free speech, unless it comes to criticizing their queen, of course. You're not allowed to do that.
So do you have any ideas after writing this book about why the Western media does tend to see Sweden and, in fact, the rest of Scandinavia through such rose-tinted glasses when there is racism, xenophobia, you know, things under the surface, under the main narrative that we would find anywhere else? Why do we see it so perfectly?
Well, first of all, I think they fulfill a need that we all have for a utopia, right? A utopia on Earth. And since the economic crash and the euro crash, we used to dream of a house in Provence or Tuscany or wherever. I think we kind of shifted our eyes north because they offered us a different set of values, a different kind of way, a formula for running society that seemed less capitalistic, less grasping, more functional, more simple, that kind of back to basics thing. And then there's what I call the White Album argument, right? Paul McCartney was once asked by a journalist, he said, shouldn't the White Album have been maybe just a one-disc album instead of a double album? Because there were some, you know, filler songs on there that weren't that good. And McCartney said, well, yeah, but it's still the White Album. And, you know, when you say that there's racism and there's xenophobia up here in the North, there is, but not that much compared to other countries in Europe. And things still function extremely well here. These are, you know, I live here of my own free will. It's a great place to live. It's safe. Things work. It's fair. It's equal. And I don't really see anywhere else that's doing it any better.
So as close to perfect as we'll find.
As I say, the book's called The Almost Nearly Perfect People. And I do, you know, sometimes I'm very critical because the media asks me to be critical. But that is genuinely how I feel about these countries.
Well, Michael Booth, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
You're welcome, Taylor. Nice to meet you.
Michael Booth is the author of The Almost Nearly Perfect People, Behind the Myth of the Scandinavian Utopia. And you can find more about the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, you can't bring up Swedish culture without bringing up its contributions to the world of pop music. While ABBA's catalog may be the first songs that come to mind when you think of Swedish pop, the Swedes have been involved in way more hits than you might realize. Take Taylor Swift's most recent album, 1989. 9 of the 13 tracks on that record were co-written by Swedish producer Max Martin. Shake it off, shake it off. But that's not the only pop song Max Martin and his gang of Swedish artists have helped produce. Here's just a sampling of the many, many, many hits they've brought to the U.S. over the years. So Sweden may not be a perfect utopia, but they do know how to churn out a good dance beat. If you've ever purchased a set of shelves from IKEA, you know the drill. Follow the detailed instructions, and a few hours, and possibly tantrums later, you'll wind up with a set of reasonably priced, sturdy shelves. But what happens when you don't follow the script? In this next story, 99% Invisible's Roman Mars explores the world of IKEA hacking.
IKEA hacking is what we've been doing.
And this is friend of the show, Sean Cole. And yes, he said IKEA hacking.
I feel good about it. It feels a little bit subversive and a little bit bourgeois.
You've probably heard of IKEA hacking. It's the practice of buying stuff from IKEA and then re-engineering it, hacking it, into customized, more functional, and often just way better designed stuff. In Sean's case, that stuff is 3 5-foot-high shelves.
Shelves from IKEA. We've laid them down on their sides.
He is drilling and screwing and bolting together one big, beautiful, queen-sized storage bed.
Wrench and bolts.
Wrench and bolts.
This is Sean's partner in crime, IKEA hacker Jonathan Bean.
4 bolts and 1 wrench.
He's an assistant professor at Bucknell University. Back in 2009, he co-wrote a serious academic paper about IKEA hacking with Daniela Rossner, who now teaches design at the University of Washington. And they got interested in part because of how bendable the term IKEA hacking is.
It could be anything from, I bought this shelf at IKEA and it was an inch too long for my closet, so I cut an inch off of it.
Or it could be where you just take, say, a salad bowl and make it into a light.
And this is Daniela.
Right, that's not even actually changing the object itself, that's just changing its use.
And the hackerati aren't just diverse in terms of their sensibility, they're diverse in the most basic way possible.
The locus of the IKEA hacking movement is a website called IKEAHackers.net.
You see hacks posted from all over this country and from Australia, Russia, Israel, Dubai. Someone posted a hack that's a French country house library in an actual French country house. He has these before and after pictures and explained all how he did it. And make no mistake, the actual posts themselves, the showing your work, that's a huge part of this whole thing. Because this is the thing. IKEA, in spite of itself, is the great leveler.
Because everything's exactly the same at IKEA, no matter where you are, it sort of lowers the barriers to recreating something. If you go and buy a stud, a wood stud at a Home Depot in the U.S., it's going to be 1.5 by 3.5 inches. If you go and buy a wood stud at Bauhaus, which is a German home improvement store, it's going to be a different size.
I mean, clearly IKEA exists, right, in these various parts of the world. So if I posted an IKEA hack in Boston and someone in the Netherlands saw it, they could probably reproduce it using this, you know, the pieces at their local store, much like a Lego kit.
And it's that very homogeneity, that McDonald's-like sameness from place to place to place, that's what's allowing this global community of hackers to thrive.
Okay, this is the best part, actually. We're about to drill unsanctioned holes into a piece of IKEA furniture.
You're not going to be able to take it back.
That's fine.
You want to have at it?
Actually, yeah. May I do the honors?
Sure.
So why is this your favorite part?
I mean, I think that it's just that for the longest time, you know, you're told that drilling holes where they're not supposed to go is destructive and wrong. And we were doing that, and it's still transgressive, and you're crossing a boundary, but it's not destruction anymore. It's creation. You know, it felt like for once I wasn't just saying, what's out there? You know, which one on the menu do I want? We were making what we wanted.
Yeah, but you were still shopping at IKEA.
True.
All right, it's the final touch. We're going to put the mattress onto my new IKEA bed. It fits! Oh boy, it's a bed! It's a bed! It's a real bed!
It's so comfortable.
That story came to us from 99% Invisible and producers Sean Cole and Roman Mars. Coming up in just a minute, the difference between normal everyday obsession, and yes, that is a thing, and obsessive compulsive disorder. Stick around.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. For the last 10 years of his life, Nikola Tesla lived in room 3327 on the 33rd floor of the New Yorker Hotel. He was obsessed with the number 3. Winston Churchill feared sea travel because he thought he might jump overboard. And the famed logician Kurt Gödel was consumed with the idea that his food was poisoned. There are compulsions or superstitions that we can all relate to, hitting home plate 3 times before swinging the bat, for example. And then there's obsessive compulsive disorder, which, as David Adams will tell you from experience, is, quote, pretty miserable. David is a writer and editor at Nature. He's author of the new book, The Man Who Couldn't Stop, OCD and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought. David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you.
So obsessive compulsive disorder seems to have been kind of casually appropriated by the masses as something of a behavioral quirk rather than a very serious disease. You know, you'll hear someone say, oh, he's OCD about his car, or, you know, I'm a little OCD when it comes to food. Why do you think we talk about it that way?
I think it's partly because people like me who have OCD have never really challenged it, because it's quite difficult to talk about OCD because it is different to that. It's not really a behavioral quirk. What it is when you get very unpleasant thoughts stuck in your mind and you find the only way you can make those go away, even if it's temporary, is to perform some kind of compulsive behavior. And almost always those thoughts are around taboo subjects, violence or sex or antisocial behavior. And people generally don't want to admit that they have those kinds of thoughts because they think people will judge them as unusual or strange, or worse, that, you know, if you have thoughts about hurting children, for example, they might actually think that you're a paedophile if you tell them that.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about your experience with OCD? How does it manifest for you?
Yeah, so I have an irrational fear of HIV and AIDS. I grew up in the 1980s when not a great deal was known about HIV and AIDS. So in the UK, and I'm sure in the US as well, we had all these public information films, which basically said, you know, have sex and you'll die, which for a 14-year-old who's never had sex is pretty grim. So that's my theme, if you like. Now, I didn't know then, but I know now that it's actually a very common theme for people my age.
Really?
Yeah. By the end of the 80s, something like a third of all OCD patients in the US had incorporated HIV into their rituals and their anxieties. So that's mine. I have this very exaggerated fear of not only catching HIV, but passing it on to people who I love. And the OCD makes me want to carry out compulsive checks, for example, to seek reassurance that I haven't caught it and that there's, for example, there's no blood on that tissue which I just blew my nose with or whatever. It is really as ridiculous as that.
Early in the book, you actually describe one of these episodes, probably an early episode, at a public swimming pool. You know, you cut your heel and then you dab it with a paper towel. Then you wonder if the paper towel, you know, was bloody before you dabbed it and whether it was someone else's blood. I wondered as I was reading this, is it difficult to write about these obsessive thoughts without indulging them, without repeating them?
To be honest, they don't need a great deal of help in coming back. They're there all the time. What you mustn't do in OCD is respond to them. So in my case, at that time, I had this cut on my ankle, and I was concerned about whether I, as you said, whether there was blood on the tissue that I'd used to press it into the wound. And what I then did was spend hours, literally hours, checking the paper towels for blood and checking the surrounds for blood. Whereas what I should have done was just walk away and live with the anxiety. But in OCD, it becomes so dominant that you feel like you just have to do those checks because you're never quite certain enough. I mean, it did make me quite sad at times writing this stuff because I do feel a bit better now. And even I find it quite hard to accept just how much it dominated my life and for so long.
You make the point in the book that just about everybody has these sort of intrusive thoughts, you know, a sudden urge to swerve into oncoming traffic or violent thoughts maybe against a stranger. So how come if everybody has those thoughts, you know, what's the difference between someone who develops OCD and the rest of us who brush them away?
That's the $64,000 question. The honest answer is that we're not quite sure. If you ask a psychologist, for example, they'll tell you it's down to psychology and patterns of thought in the brain. If you ask a neuroscientist, they'll point to some brain scans that show differences in the way that the brain processes information. You know, if you ask a Freudian, they'll say it's all down to childhood fantasies about sex with your parents or whatever. I think we can discount the last one. But
I hope so.
But certainly, I think the easiest way to explain it is through psychology, and that it's not having the thought that's the problem, but it's the way that thought is interpreted. For example, one of the important personality traits in OCD seems to be an inflated sense of responsibility. So you mentioned the thought that most people might have at some point when they're driving is to, you know, what would happen if I was just to steer the car into the oncoming traffic or off the road? And most people would just think, oh, what a strange thought, and then they'd carry on. Whereas if you have this heightened sense of responsibility, if you feel you have, there's a special emphasis on you to avoid causing harm to yourself or others, then you might change the way you drive. You might think, oh, you know what? Yeah, maybe I should just slow down a bit just in case I do that. Or I'll just grip the steering wheel a little bit tighter to make sure that I don't act on that thought. And then once you've reacted in that way to the thought, then you then give it credibility and it's more likely to come back. And so you need to perform the compulsion again. And very quickly, you get into this very destructive cycle. And it's not too difficult to imagine someone deciding that they're just not going to drive because of that. And that is how a thought that most people would have can very perniciously sort of cling on.
I have to wonder why you decided to become a journalist. You know, you do a lot of reporting on science. You have a job that's all about rooting out the rational scientific truth when you have a condition that's focused so much on the irrational. Was that a conscious choice for you, or were you sort of battling the condition in your own way?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you're a journalist, so I won't say what I was going to say, which is that maybe only journalism would have me.
but, I'll take it.
But I think it's separate. I think it's a very specific blind spot in my case about risk and hazard and threat. For example, I have no issues with getting on an aeroplane. You know, I know there's a very small chance that the aeroplane will crash, and people do die in plane crashes every year. But I accept that risk and I get on with it. Whereas when it comes to HIV, because of the OCD, I can't react in that way. I think, you know, to say that I handled something so irrational by going into a profession that caused me to seek out rationality is too rational a response in a way. You know, there are people with OCD who do everything. You mentioned Kurt Gödel, the mathematician. You know, he lived his whole life for rationality and logic. And yet he had this side to him that was wildly irrational, ended up killing him.
We're speaking with David Adam, author of The Man Who Couldn't Stop. It's a book that's part memoir, part history book, and partly a sort of scientific review of obsessive compulsive disorder. At one point in your life, you actually started repeatedly calling the National AIDS Helpline. How did you think that they would be able to help you?
I just thought they'd tell me, no, you can't catch AIDS like that, and that would work.
But then you had to keep calling and be reassured.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I would call them, you know, I would play football and I would hurt my leg on the AstroTurf and I'd cut my leg and there'd be blood. And I'd start to think, well, someone else could have done that at that exact same spot on the football pitch. And they could have left blood and it could have got into my knee when I fell over that exact same spot. And so I would think that's really unlikely, but it might happen. And I'd become very anxious about it. So I would call this number and I would explain this scenario. And they would say to me, no, you know, nothing to worry about there. The risk is very low. And I would say, thanks very much. And I'd hang up the phone. And then I'd think, very low. So that's not zero. So I should call back just to make sure. Mm-hmm. And in this way, I got a little hit of reassurance because they would say, yeah, nothing to worry about. And then the doubt would creep in and I'd have to call back again. And every time I thought, I just need to get one more dose of reassurance and then that will be it. But it never is.
Do we know what percentage of the population suffers from some sort of OCD or another?
Well, OCD itself is between about 2-3%, so about 1 in 40 people.
Wow.
But then there is a whole load of what's called spectrum conditions, which are now thought to relate to OCD. So you can, if you like, you can draw that spectrum very broadly to include things like eating disorders, because those are based around very intrusive thoughts. And compulsive behaviours, either not eating or over binge eating. You can include things like Tourette syndrome, which is quite often driven by, you know, compulsive twitches or actions. You can include things like hoarding, where people feel a compulsive need not to hang on to stuff, to not throw it away. Things like compulsive picking at the skin and compulsive pulling out of hair. And then you can even, some people would extend it to things like a compulsive gambling or compulsive shopping, just this sort of inability to stop doing something. And so when you start to think of it in those terms, then, you know, everybody knows somebody who is affected.
So you did eventually seek treatment. How did you come to that decision and what do you do? What do you do to battle it?
It took a long time, probably about the best part of 20 years until I had a daughter, a baby daughter, and I found myself transferring my fears onto her, so I would start to think that I might give her HIV. And apparently this is quite common when people have children. It really does change the way their OCD works. There was one particular incident where I found myself concerned that she might have rubbed blood into her eyes and I was putting it in and out of a childhood, in and out of a playground swing to try and make sure that she hadn't. And I just thought, this has to stop. You know, kids watch you and they copy you or they ask what you're doing.
Right.
I thought it just there's no way I can involve her in this, so it has to stop. And I rang the doctors the next day, and very, very luckily, I lived in the catchment area for one of the best OCD units in the country, here in the UK. So I was able to go and get treatment, which is, and I think it's the same in the US, it's a combination of drugs. So they give you quite high doses of antidepressants, things like Prozac, not that we're depressed, but it just seems to help. And then you have what's called cognitive behavioural therapy, which is sort of regular sessions, both to teach you a bit about the way thoughts are interpreted and can be misinterpreted, to try and watch out for that. And then the behavioural therapy, which is pretty grim, really, where they provoke the anxiety by exposing you to what it is that you're sort of obsessed about, but then they stop you or ask you not to perform the compulsion.
Does it sort of force you to cope with it?
Exactly, yeah. So it's a bit like, you know, the reason I phoned the National AIDS Helpline was to get that little jolt of reassurance, which even though it was only temporary, it did help, whereas you don't do that. So what you do is you provoke, by doing that, what you do is you provoke the anxiety and then don't give people the chance to take the easy way out.
Earlier, we talked a little bit about how people have sort of appropriated and misused OCD. And it's wild because even as I listen to you talk about how this really is a disease and how this thought could take over your life, you know, I can imagine in myself and how others would listen to this and still be able to somehow relate that behavior to the sort of lesser behaviors that we all have. And I wonder, do you worry at all that people who hear about or read this book will be tempted to pathologize their own behavior, to continue to do what we've been doing?
No, I don't think so. I think when people talk about, you know, they have a little bit of OCD, I think what they actually have is a little bit of O and C, you know, because there is a degree of, if you want to call it normal obsessiveness, and there is a degree of normal compulsiveness. So people who have to check the back door is locked twice before they go to bed, or as you mentioned, the is it a baseball thing, you know, hitting the plate.
Right, right. The superstition.
As a superstition, but you know, but then he hits the ball or tries to hit the ball. So that isn't a disruption upon someone's life. If you've got a baseball player who is never ready, he's tapping the plate and then he thinks, did I tap it three times or twice? I better do it again just to make sure. And he's doing that again and again and again. Then he's not going to play for very long. Is he? He's going to get taken off. He's going to get taken off the team. So that's the D. It's when the obsessions and the compulsions, which can be within the normal range, get to the point where it takes over your life. And this idea that, you know, we can pathologize normal behavior. Well, people know if they need help. I knew, and most people with severe OCD know. The fact that you have a tic or a habit or a superstition or a minor compulsion is just part of being human.
Well, David, thank you so much for speaking with us today. We appreciate it.
No, thank you.
David Adam is a writer and editor for Nature and author of the book The Man Who Couldn't Stop, OCD and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought. There's a link to more on his book at wordofmouthradio.org. Life is a series of habits. They help us flow through complex tasks, like driving a car, without concentrating on every single move we're doing. But diseases like drug addiction, Tourette syndrome, OCD, and even Parkinson's disease hijack habit circuitry and make it work against us. For decades, scientists have used animals and technologies like MRI to study how habits work in the brain and how they take control. And now, neuroscientist Kyle Smith and his team of researchers are fighting back. Kelly Prime brings us this story.
Habits are stubborn. Ask any smoker. They lurk in your brain, quiet and unnoticed, until something triggers a craving. Galen Koch struggles with smoking, and she says triggers are everywhere.
Drinking, smoke and smoke
is a cue.
Emotional cues,
stress,
like social stress.
Being at a party, feeling like you want to leave.
Seeing people smoke in movies is huge, especially if
that,
they look
if they're
good.
Nasty people, it doesn't do it as much, but like watching old French films, like I'm done for. I have to go smoke a cigarette.
A craving hits and you can't help yourself. Zero control. You're having that cigarette. And that's because habits are permanent. Once you pick one up, it's wired in your brain forever. But the brain is complex, and cravings don't always get the final say. Kyle Smith and his team of researchers at Dartmouth College are trying to figure out how the brain controls habits, and how habits are controlling you. Right now, I'm in Kyle's basement laboratory. A few days ago, he put electrodes deep in a rat's head to turn brain activity into sound.
So what you're hearing is there's a hum just coming from the static. Behind that little hum, the white noise, there's these little like clicky sort of sounds, and that's every time you hear that is the neuron firing, responding, and it comes in little bursts.
To the untrained ear, that sound is static. But these scientists can hear from the clicks whether a cell is on or off. They're listening to the chatter of cells deep in the brain where habits are stored, and trying to figure out how to stop that chatter, how to break a habit. First, the scientists train rats in a maze made of clear plexiglass with an open top. It's shaped like a plus sign, so when the rat gets to the middle, it has to decide which way it wants to go.
They'll stop there, they'll pause, and they actually look down each arm as though thinking about that as an option, and then they'll make a choice. And as they get habitual, that goes away. They just, boom, they just turn, they know what they want to do. As though the decision was made already from the beginning.
Now the rat turns right, every time. And the scientists try to break that habit using a technology called optogenetics. Basically, they're shooting a laser into light-sensitive cells in the rat's brain. The laser turns cells on. So the rat's running along pretty much on autopilot. Just when it starts turning right, the scientists shine a yellow laser through fiber optic wires into the brain and... something happens.
What we see is the return of this sort of behavior where, again, they're thinking, if I can say that word about rats, thinking about what they're doing and what the consequences might be.
Yes, it sounds like science fiction. Yes, it's real. To understand how lasers can take a rat off autopilot, we need to know a little bit more about how the brain works. Habits are stored in cells deep in the brain. But in order for a person or a rat to actually act on that habit, the cells need permission from another brain area called the cortex.
The upper layer, probably the most evolved part in the human.
And the cortex needs a cue.
Something like the movie Breathless. The lead character and the woman like just had sex and then they're like laying in bed together and they both light a cigarette. And in my head, I'm just thinking, oh, that would be nice.
Your cortex notices that trigger and you crave a cigarette. Then the cortex sends a signal to start the habit and another to end it. You pick up the cigarette, smoke it, and put it down. But if the cortex signals too soon, you don't act on your craving. You break the habit. And that's exactly what Kyle is doing with his laser. The light jumpstarts cells in the cortex and makes them fire too soon, interrupting the habit. The tricky thing about this research is that it can't target just one habit and leave the others alone.
People are capable of multiple habits at once. You'd really want to avoid screwing up your other habits.
The good habits are all mixed up with the bad ones. And that makes this technology too dangerous to consider using in humans. Still, what Kyle and his team are doing is a big deal. They're targeting habits in the brain and bringing choice back into the equation. And since rat brains and human brains are structured almost identically, this research is a huge step forward toward understanding human habits and hopefully developing interventions to control them. No lasers necessary. For Salt Radio, this is Kelly Prime.
When we come back, we'll hear from Only a Game's Bill Littlefield on his latest book, a volume of sports-related poetry. That's in just a minute on Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth!
Bill Littlefield has tackled sports from every literary angle, as a commentator, a columnist, an essayist, a novelist, and now as a poet. In his latest book, Take Me Out, Littlefield uses poetic verse to cover all sorts of games, from football to baseball, chess to roller derby. You probably know Bill Littlefield as the host of NPR's Only a Game, heard every Saturday morning right here on NHPR. And Bill Littlefield, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
So let's start with your poem about Olympians. They may not be giants. Could you read that one for us?
Sure. It won't take very long.
Well, we picked it for a reason.
That's good. They might not be giants. Olympians need not be giants. They need not be tall. The female gymnasts at the games are sometimes kind of small.
So this is a great one. And one reason I really enjoyed it is that, you know, of course, you've written poems here about mainstream sports like baseball and football, but you've got a lot of off the beaten path sports as well. Was it hard to compose poems about gymnastics or squash or croquet?
No, it was challenging. And it was fun. There was really nothing, no labor involved in this. It was just fun. And that has distinguished it from every other book I've written. The others were hard work. This was fun.
Do you feel like you really know enough about every sport to compose a poem, or did you have to do any research?
Very little research, because doggerel, the kind of poetry that I write, really doesn't lend itself very much to research. No, it was just, you know, kind of goofy stuff. Squash is a vegetable as well as a game, so I had some fun with that, you know, that sort of thing.
As I was looking over the poems, I realized that I could only think of a couple poems, aside from your book about sports, Casey at the Bat being the only one that I think people might recognize. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is, that we don't see so much poetry about sports?
Well, I think there is actually a fair amount of poetry about sports. Homer wrote about boxing, and he wasn't too bad a poet. So, you know, we can go all the way up to that. And Donald Hall up there in New Hampshire writing about Ted Williams not so very long ago. So it's out there. You have to kind of look for it, but it's out there.
You've got to weed through the romance?
Yeah, yeah, and the cliches that generally constitute sports writing.
Well, you know, speaking of cliches, I think that a lot of us are led to believe that literature and a love of sports are sort of diametrically opposed. But do you think that's the case, or do you think sports are really good fodder for literature?
Oh, I think historically sports have been spectacularly good fodder for literature. I can name numbers of writers and novels and short story writers who have made all sorts of good use of sports. The one I was thinking about earlier today was Mark Harris, who wrote Bang the Drum Slowly and the whole series of wonderful Henry Wiggin novels. You can go all the way back to Damon Runyon and the brilliant stuff that he wrote that passed as sports writing, but really it was literature. And I've had the opportunity over the years to read a great deal of it. W.C. Hines, Bill Hines, who a brilliant, brilliant writer, and to the great benefit of sports, he wrote about sports.
And then, of course, there's folks like Charlie Pierce, who we hear on the show every week.
There is Charlie Pierce, who not only writes brilliantly about sports, but talks brilliantly about sports, at least on a weekly basis.
So what makes it good writing? Is it, I mean, I wouldn't think it would necessarily be the sport as subject, but the subject as a vehicle?
Well, sometimes the subject really does lend itself to good writing because there's suspense built into most athletic competitions and character. You see what happens to players who fail and what happens to players who succeed. And, of course, an athletic career is a kind of short version of a life where you're old in baseball terms. For example, by the time you're in your mid-30s, late 30s at the latest, you may have half your life still to lead, but you're an old man in terms of your legs not being quite as good as they used to be and your eye not being as sharp. So you get that kind of compressed version of what it's like to live a life acted out in front of thousands or millions of people.
Yeah, and then there's the underdog stories and I suppose the scandals too, like Armstrong.
Altogether too many of them. But yeah. Yes, you're right. They're all human interest stories and they all take place in the context of games.
Do you find that certain sports make for better narrative arcs than others? I mean, we were talking about this. We couldn't think of a single novel that, you know, featured a tennis player so much as we could think of so many baseball ones.
Well, Martina Navratilova wrote, or at least allegedly wrote, a couple of mystery novels that were set in tennis. But I'm not sure how good they were. I didn't read them. But you're right. Some sports probably lend themselves to great storytelling. Baseball certainly has going for it the incredible amount of history and the statistics and the myths and the way you can go to a ball game and see a young player and say, well, gee, you know, that guy reminds me a little bit of fill in the blank with your favorite shortstop or center fielder. So there is that kind of background that's available to anybody who is inclined to write about it. And drama is built in, as I say, to pretty much all sports where competition is involved.
In fact, you wrote a novel about baseball called Prospect.
Prospect was born in part out of my acquaintance with a guy who'd been a major league scout for many years. And I met him and I was fascinated by him. It was a guy named Lenny Marullo who played shortstop for the Cubs back in the 40s and then made a long career as a major league scout when his playing career was over. And he just had so many stories about guys that he had scouted. And the more I looked, the more stories there were. And I thought, well, this would be a scout would be a great narrator for a novel because anytime I ran out of a gas in terms of moving the plot forward, I'd just have him tell another baseball story and that would take up several pages. And it worked out pretty well.
Do you think, speaking of those off the beaten path sports, that we're likely to see a great American novel about gymnastics anytime soon?
Anything is available, you know. A good writer who's fascinated by something and enthusiastic about it and can bring energy to the task, the subject really is secondary, I think.
Today, we are seeing more and more in-depth coverage of sports. I'm thinking of ESPN's documentary series 30 for 30, mm-hmm. Websites like Grantland. Do you think we're entering a golden age of sports writing in journalism?
That's an excellent question. We're certainly entering an age where a lot of what used to be called journalism is appearing in places other than newspapers or magazines, that's for sure. And some of it is terrific. All you have to do is look at Houghton Mifflin's annual collection of best American sports writing, and you see that more and more of it is coming from blogs or websites, and it's spectacularly good.
Bill Littlefield is the host of NPR's Only a Game and author of several books, including his latest, Take Me Out. It's a collection of illustrated poetry. And Bill, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Before we go, is there a specific poem from the collection that you'd like to read? Another one?
Since you mentioned sports that are a little bit out of the mainstream, how about one on polo? Is that all right?
Polo sounds perfect.
Okay, here we go. There is this game called polo. It's a splendid game, of course. You swing a mallet at a ball while riding on a horse. You ride upon the horse, I mean. The ball is on the ground, and when you whack the ball, it makes a very pleasing sound, a kind of thwack, I guess you'd say, much deeper than a click. And doing all this on a horse is quite a clever trick. I'm sure the people playing polo have a lot of fun. The horses? I don't really know. I've never questioned one.
Thanks for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can also follow us, send us your feedback, or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
With help from our interns,
Fiona Shea and Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.